Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Lamed Hey Amud Aleph. How have a kosh shochiv? There was a person who was laying on his deathbed. Amrulei itete the man. Who should your wife marry? Amrulehu chazir lekan rabo. She can marry even the kohen agadol. So here again, the Rishonim try to decipher exactly what is being said here. But it's seemingly we have a situation in which we have an individual who has brothers. And if this individual passes away, then his wife would be subject to Yibum. You can see that in the Rashbam. Va'ilu achim, v'lo benin. He had brothers, but no children. The Muksak li'Yibum. Then we would have assumed that the wife would have to either have Yibum or Chalitza performed with her. So they ask him, what should happen with the wife? The question could be either, what's the story with your wife here? Is there any information we should know? Or they might have even asked him, which of the brothers should be the one to perform Yibum over here? And he gives them a surprising answer, which is, she is Uya the Kohen Gadol. She is ready to be married to a Kohen Gadol. Now obviously that presents a problem because of the fact that a Kohen Gadol can only marry a Betulah and cannot marry an Almanah. Kohen Hedjot could marry an Almanah, but not a Kohen Gadol. For that reason, it leads to numerous interpretations here, as well as changes in the girsa. You can already see that in the Rashbam, who says Chazir Lekana. He doesn't have Lekana Rabba, he just says Chazir Lekana, that she is Ruya for a Kohen, not Ruya for a Kohen Gadol. And I was learning with my brother-in-law, he suggested that maybe this woman was somehow engaged halakhically at a Rusin, but not Nisuin, and therefore she could be a Betulah. And I saw that the Rimigash and the Yad Ramah both indicate something along those lines. But that seems a little more far-fetched, because from the story it sounds like they're fully married, that there was Nisuin over here. And that Nisuin is now going to terminate with his death, and that's going to subject her to Yibum. But he makes a statement that indicates otherwise, that she is not subject to Yibum. So why is it that she's not subject to Yibum? So if you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says over here, it's lav davka kamar lekana rabo. It wasn't davka, she said to a Kohen Gadol, because he can't marry an almanah. Elo l'chol kana hedyot. She could marry any Kohen hedyot. Da'ai itlai b'nei. Because he says, I have children. So his statement here was, I have children, unbeknownst to you, I have children. And therefore, those children are going to protect her from Yibum. She's protected from Yibum, then she's permitted to marry the Kohen hedyot. That's the view of the Rabbeinu Gershom. On the other hand, the Rashbam, who we said before as a girsav, not Kana Rabba, but just Kahana, says Lav Dafka. Says not only is it Lav Dafka by a Kohen Gadol, it's Lav Dafka by a Kohen as well. Because the Nemanut over here of this individual stems from the fact that he can say, I divorced her. The reason that we would believe him to say that she's not subject to Yibum is because he could solve the problem himself right now by divorcing her on the spot. If he divorced her on the spot, she wouldn't be subject to Yibum. That's why he has believability. But so the migo that stems from the gerushin is what gives him nemanut. But if the migo is premised on gerushin, then she can't marry a kohen. Because the underlying assumption is that even if he is not telling the truth, malo l'shaker, because he could have divorced her. But if he divorced her, then she would not be ruiyah. Certainly not to a kohen gadol, but even for a kohen hejot. And for that reason, he says, miyo l'kana asira. Dalo patrina la'el bitanat gerashti et ishti. She is not permitted to marry a Kohen Hedyot because the whole premise of the believability here stems from the fact that he could have said, Gerashti et Ishti. The Balei Tosafot say something similar. They even go as far as to say you can leave in Kohen Gadol. If the Rashbams are going to say Kohen Hedyot was Lav Dafka, then put in Kohen Gadol also. It could be Lav Dafka. And just Vamir, the Shapir Geres Rabot, half the Kohen Hedyot Asira. Not only is she not permitted to Kohen Gadol, she's not permitted to a Kohen Hedyot, and therefore it's clear that the Kohen Gadol here, or Kohen Rabba, is a guzma. It's just an exaggeration saying that she can do as she pleases, she can marry anyone she wants. Obviously there are limitations based on a Kohen Gadol, but just saying that she is not subject to Yibum. So that's the view of the Rashbam, the Balei Tosafot, although as we mentioned yesterday, in the Balei Tosafot yesterday, and other Rishonim, they believe that not only can she marry not only can she marry anyone she wants, she could actually marry a Kohen Hedyot. Because the Migo, Mali the Shaker, is what gives him the believability. But then we don't tag him or tag her with the Gerushin and suggest that she was divorced. and therefore she can't marry a kohen. Once we believe her, amali l'shaker. So theoretically, since he could have divorced her, we believe him now, and that believability will extend to any party. That means even to a kohen ha'jot, because we don't have a divorce in front of us, and therefore she could even marry a kohen ha'jot. So that's the view of the Ramban, speculates in it, but other Rishonim after him take it as a given that you could marry a kohen. So that's the, as far as the language of Kana Rabba over here. So now, Omer Rava, a likely Girsi is probably Rabba, you'll see, because Rava appears later on in the Sugya, and so it would make more sense that Rabba is speaking here in the beginning. My Nechushla, what do we have to worry about over here? Hama Rabbi Chia bar Abba Amar Rabbi Yochanan. So this is the quote that we had from Rabbi Yochanan yesterday. Baal She'amar Girashti Et Ishti Ne'aman. A husband who says that I divorced my wife is believed, because even if he is lying, technically, he could divorce her right now. So Malo Lo Shakir. Why would he say we are divorced if he could just hand her the divorce now? Now, we saw yesterday was the difference between retroactive and prospective. Retroactively, he's not believed, but he is believed prospectively. So over here, too, that's what drives the Rishbam and the Balei Tosafot to say over here that she can't marry a Kohen, because the Nemanut stems from the fact that he's could say that we were divorced. And that's what ruins her standing in terms of a Kohen. Others just say it's amigo, it's a Malei L'Shaker, but that doesn't change her standing as being a woman, doesn't require Yibum, and therefore can go to marry anyone she wants without any Chalitza, without any release. Amalei Abaye. So Abaye says back to him, so either it's back to Rava or Rava, his Rebbe, would make more sense here. Vaha, don't we have the other memra of Rabbi Yochanan? Kiata Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef and Rabbi Yochanan. Baal Shema Gerashti Et Ishti Einu Ne'eman. We said there that he is not believed. So we have two memraot from Rabbi Yochanan. One that said that he is believed when he says we got divorced. And the other one where he says he's not believed when he says we got divorced. So Rabba says back to Abaye, Velav mi lo shanino. Didn't we already reconcile these two statements of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yosef as well, who also said that the Baal is Ne'eman? Kan lemafreya, kan la'aba. There's a difference between what the statement was. If he's trying to state that retroactively at an earlier date we were divorced, we will not believe him. If he's trying to state that we are divorced now, he gives no date to it, or he says we are divorced as of now, then we would believe him, because he could simulate that effect by just handing her a get right now. So why lie and say we are divorced? Retroactively, it's more precarious. We saw yesterday the two interpretations of the Mafreya, the Rashbam, who says he's just giving an earlier date, and then later on we get Edim coming in and say that she had an extramarital affair. Or according to the Rabbeinu Gershom, it was literally, there was already an extramarital affair, and now he's saying we were divorced before that, after we already have that information. But either way, you have a way to distinguish within Rabbi Yochanan's statement. If that's the case, over here where the Baal says that we are divorced, we would believe him. And similarly over here, this individual on his deathbed can declare his wife not subject to Yibum, because he could divorce her on the spot and he would be believed. So if he says that she doesn't need Yibum, why shouldn't we believe him? So then Abaye says back to him, Vashnuye Nikom Velismach? Are we going to rely on this answer? The way the Rashbam terms it is, how do you know that the Amoraim, who are quoting Rabbi Yochanan, are not arguing about what Rabbi Yochanan said? It's nice that we can reconcile it. It's nice that we came up with a solution. But who says that that solution is correct and it wasn't just a machloket Amoraim? If that's the case, you have a safek here as to whether the Baal is Ne'aman when he says, Girashti et ishti. And if he has a safek, or we don't know, then you have to leave the woman bechazkata. And the chazak over here is that he has brothers. He has no children, and that means that she would be subject to Yibum or require Chalitza in order to release her to the public at large. So that's Abaye's answer to him, is it's a nice answer, but who says that that is the right answer? And at least we should be Choshesh for that fact. Amalei Rova, the Rav Ninatan Bar Ami, that's what I said before, that it makes more sense. It's Rabba, because over here Rova says, Chushla, we should be suspicious of it. So now, the way, the mainstream way to read it is, chushla means, let's worry about Abaye's suggestion over here. Maybe Abaye is right, that the answer that we're giving is not the proper answer to reconcile Rabbi Yochanan. And that means that there's a safek. And in a safek, the chazaka governs. And that means that she would be required to either do Yibum or perform chalitza. In this case, we'd likely only do chalitza, because there is at least a safek, because he's declaring her not needing of Yibum. And we have a chazaka that she needs Yibum, and so the tension between those would force us to say that there should be chalitza. If you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom over here says, chushla, latira, the ne'aman, the nismocha shnuye. He brings an alternative view, it's chushla, that we should suspect, not suspect in a negative sense, but we should consider or accept the solution to the stira in Rabbi Yochanan. In that way, she would be muteret, the gamre. Then he brings Igad Amre, that chushla is the negative sense, which is, let's be suspicious and worry about what Rabbi says, and then you would have to do chalitza, and not say that she is free to the shuk. So you have actually both views within the Rabbeinu Gershom, although the mainstream view is chushla, like from the language it sounds like, will be suspicious of this answer. If that's the case, then we have to worry about the fact that she may be chayevet in Yibum, and we won't release her without chalitza. We had a individual who, we had a chazaka that he did not have brothers. Va'amar bishad mita, and then at his death, he says, he says, I don't have brothers. So he supports or confirms the chazaka that we've had until now, that he doesn't have brothers. Zamar of Yosef, what should we worry about here? We have a chazaka and the statement of the mate that both say he doesn't have brothers. Why should we worry about anything? Chado, the muchzak lan delet le'achid. First of all, we have a chazaka that he has no brothers. So that would be supportive. If he had said nothing, that would be supportive of the fact that she doesn't need Yibum. Vod, hamar bishad mita delet le. And on top of that, he makes that declaration at the time of death that he has no brothers. Now again here, he could have Nemanut because he could simply divorce her and not require her to have Yibum anyway, even if he did have brothers. So the fact that he says he doesn't have brothers, again, Malo Lishakir. There's no reason for him to lie about that, and she should not be subject to Yibum. Amalei Abaye. So it's a similar setup to before, which also would indicate that the Girsa before should be Rabbah, because there you had Rabbah making a statement, and then Abaye, the Talmud, questioning him, but he says that there's nothing to worry about. Here, the other Rebbe of Abaye, who's Rav Yosef, a peer of Rabbah's, here Abaye also questions when he says, what are we worrying about? Abaye gives him something to worry about, which is, Amar le Abaye, Hamre, Dike Dim, Bididinat Ayam, Diyoda, Dit Le Ache. Wait a minute, the case here is not as clean as you're saying. It's not a case where we have a chazaka that no brothers, and he says no brothers. There is this rumor circulating. The way that we have the Girsa in our Gemara is Amrei de'ika edim b'dinat hayam. They say that there are edim b'dinat hayam that know that he has brothers. There are other Girsaot that say ika edim b'dinat hayam, that there are edim b'dinat hayam, and that is rejected by the Balei HaTosafot over here. You know that it exists because the Balei HaTosafot uphold this Girsa that says Amrei, that they are. You have a tension here, which is you're dealing with rumors, and on the other side of this, it's a fact that could alter the case. So what the Balei HaTosafot suggests is, if it was simply rumors that are just circulating out there, something that has no substance to it, then of course we would ignore it, because we can't worry about every rumor that exists. On the other hand, if it is something that we know for certain that there are edim out there that could shed light on the situation, we'd have to go find those edim and deal with them. So it's got to be this in-between case, which is that we have rumors that there are edim that have information. And the rumors, as the Balei HaTosafot would say, are pretty substantiated. They ended up in court, meaning that the evidence for this issue was brought before the court that there might be edim overseas. So it's enough for us to be suspicious, but not enough for us to say that it's absolute. So now Rabbi Yosef says back to him, Hashta miyah let nehu come on. The edim aren't here. And what the Rishbam says is, Ein ledayan ela mesha ein avrot. A dayan can only paskin based on the information that is in front of him. This is information we don't have. It's information that's not present now. And therefore, we're going to ignore it. We're not going to deal with it. And therefore, again, my lechushla, what is there to worry about in this case? You have a chazaka and a statement of the mate that he doesn't have brothers. Where it says, la vainu de Rabbi Chanina. Isn't this similar to the case of Rabbi Chanina? Da amar Rabbi Chanina, edim b'tzad istan v'te'aser. You have a dam in Istan, some place far north, and you're going to worry about it. The context of this statement is in the Gemara Ketubot, has to do with the Benate de Shmuel, the daughters of Shmuel, who were taken into captivity. And then later, they are released, well, at least one of them marries their captors. It's a very convoluted and complex case, but they end up being brought to Eretz Yisrael. And when they come to Eretz Yisrael, they tell their captors to wait outside. They go into the Beit Midrash, and they say, we were taken into captivity, but we are to Orim. And they know, they're smart women, they obviously know the halacha, because they know a pesha asur u a pesha itir. If they're the only evidence of the fact that they were taken into captivity, then they can also declare themselves to Orim. If the captors had come into the Beit Midrash or presented themselves, then we would have outside evidence, independent evidence of the fact they were taken into captivity, and then they would not be believed. So they told the captors to stay outside. They went into the Beit Midrash. Rabbi Chanina says, well, Pesha also Pesha Hitir. Someone says to him, wait a minute, there are Edei Tumah out in Istan. So he says, they're not here. We're going to worry about Edim that are out there. We're going to make them Asurim because of Edim. We don't have those Edim now. We've got to deal with what's in front of us. So what either the Gemara is saying or Rav Yosef is indicating over here is that this should be the exact same thing. Here, too, we have evidence in front of us that indicates she's not chayavid in Yibum. You have some suspicion of Edim in a far-flung place. Why should we worry about them? Just like Rabbi Chanina says, we're not going to worry about them. So too, over here, we shouldn't worry about them. So Amar Lei Abaye, im ekalnu bishvuya, if we were willing to be mekel by a shvuya, which we find many dinim of the Chachamim, that try to be mekel by shvuya in order to free her of the burden of being deemed a zonah and not being able to marry a kohen, we say, for instance, Eid Echad, Isha, Eved can testify on behalf of the woman. All the normal trappings of a dude are dropped over here in order to facilitate the ability of this woman to prove her being pure still and not being taken advantage by the captors and able to marry a kohen. So that's what Abaye says, Mikano Bishvuya. The next line the Gemara the Rishbam takes out. And then you have this line, Mishum Demnavla Nafshad Gabe Shabai, which is, depending if you put it in or not, Nekel Be'eshadish. We're going to be Nekel by a married woman. Amarle Rav the Rabbi Natan Barami. So again here, Rav at the end of the conversation says, Rabbi Natan Chushla. And the Rabbeinu Gershom brings both versions down again. Chushla is, Rabbi Yosef is right. Forget about what Abaye says. Or Ikadami, which is the more mainstream view, which is Chushla, we have to worry about what Abaye raised, the question he raised, negative Rabbi Yosef. And therefore, we're going to have to worry about it in this case. Mishum Nimnavla Nafsho the Gabe Shabai. The Rishbam takes out, because he says it's a Perush that got dropped into the Gemara. The Perush is the explanation for why we believe the women in this case. And he says it's not necessary over here, and it has nothing to do with the case. Others who have the girsa, including the Rif, and many others who have the girsa in, then are defended by the typical Rishonim, like the Ramban, who say that this is the main reason for why Rabbi Chanina believed the Benot Shmuel. And that is because of this principle, Mishum Na'avla Na'afshad Gabe Shavai. The woman does her utmost to make herself ugly and unappealing to the captors. That's why, in general, we have a chazakah that the woman is tehora, or we want to believe that she is tehora. So if we have no contrary evidence that she was taken into captivity, and then there was a risk that she was taken advantage of, and she should not be able to marry a kohen after this because now she has a din of a zonah, so if we have some countervailing evidence like the pesha also pesha hitir, or the edim are far-flung and we only have rumors about them and we don't know anything about them, then we're going to opt in favor of the women to say that the women themselves also do their utmost not to fall victim to the captors. And that's what is meant here, Mishum Na'avla Na'afshad Gabe Shavai. Now that'll have implications now, because Rabbi Yossi started out, what are we going to worry about? I have a chazakah that I have no brothers. And he says, I have no brothers. Yeah, we have this rumor about Edim. You're going to say what to worry about? I'll tell you what to worry about. The Abaye says there's a difference in cases. By Shvuya, you could be Mekiel, because that's the whole premise of the cases of Shvuya, is that we're trying to help the woman out. Since we're trying to help the woman out, we're going to be Mekiel in many issues. But that's not true by the case of Eshed Ish. So depending on what you said, according to the Rishbam, the Hakalah by Shvuya is that we allow Eid Echad, we allow Eidei Psulim to come out and help out, Pesha Asu, Pesha Hitir, we have all these Hakalot. But by Eshed Ish, by our case, how can you be Mekiel? Because there's an issue of Eshed Ish, which we'll discuss in 1 second. On the other hand, those that keep the Girsa in Mishum Demavla Nafshal Gabe Shavai, over there is countervailing evidence, or we think that the woman would have not fallen prey to the men because she's trying her utmost to make herself unappealing to the captors. That's not true here by the case of Eshed Ish. You don't have that countervailing force that says that we should not worry about the Edim, because over here, why shouldn't we worry about the Edim? There's reason to believe that the Edim have information that's helpful to us, and we should then at least check into them. Now, the two sides here are Shvuya versus Eshed Ish. The problem with that is that there's no Eshed Ish over here. The woman was married to this individual, and he passed away. She's no longer a married woman. The only thing she has left on her is the restriction for a woman who is supposed to perform Yibum to go and marry an outsider. Lo tia ishet ameta chutza li ishzar. She may not marry a third party unless she has chalitza. But that's an iser lav. And the way that Rashbam phrases it, well, by kohen, to marry a zonah, that's only a light isur. It's an isur lav. Over here, we're talking about an isur of eshet ish. There's no isur of eshet ish here. There's the same isur lav over here. It's the same lav. So what's the Gemara saying here? Oh, shvuya is kula, and eshet ish is the chumrah. There is no eshet ish over here. Then the Rashbam says something even more surprising in explaining this. And he says here, Deika isur chenek. Varihi becheskat isur arata. She was a married woman until now, and therefore that status will remain with her, and the punishment for Neshet Ish is an Isur Chenek. What's the Rishbam speaking about? There's no Isur Chenek over here. Isur Chenek terminated when the husband died. There's no Neshet Ish left here. There's only a restriction in Isur Lav to marry out. And what does that mean? That there's a Cheskat Isur Adata. The Cheskat Isur until now was that she was married. The Isur that we're dealing with right now is the Isur of Yibum, or not performing Yibum when you're supposed to. It has nothing to do with the marriage beforehand. So if you look in the Gota Bach, it already notes there's a huge problem here with the Rishbam saying Isur Chenek. And the Bach says, V'nir b'aynai, da'af agav da'achshav eina eshet ish, even though currently she's not an eshet ish, v'leka chenek, and there is no chenek over here. Ki im lav, the same lav that we just discussed, which is, t'lo te'eshet amet achutza, mikol makom, me'achar dekodem shemet bala hayta b'cheska de'eshet ish. Since prior to this point in time, she was under a chazak v'eshish, a dayin b'chazkat oto isur omedet. Wow. That isur remains, v'zeu isur chenek. Lo chenek mamash, it doesn't mean literally chenek, rak isur chenek shayaba lo nistalek mimena. That isur has not disappeared from her, and she niftara mizikat v'ma, until she is released from the zika of the yibum. So this goes back to v'yivamot. When we speak about the Zika, the Yibum, or how much of the original marriage is embedded in the new marriage of the Yibum. And what we're saying here is that the Zika, the Yibum, or the Isur to marry out when you're waiting or awaiting Yibum, yes, it's only a lav. Lo tia isha demeta chutz lishzar. It's only a simple lav. But that lav derives from a circumstance or situation that was ishit ish. And that means that this lav, if you view it as a continuation of the previous marriage, takes on a higher form of isur. You're right, it doesn't result in chenek, but it is the derivative of chenek. It's a continuation. And we have a principle, and this is the Rashbam, is consistent here, is whether machzikim isur li isur. If you have a chazok of an isur, and then that isur disappears, but then it folds directly into another isur, do we say then that the first isur rolls into the second isur as a chazakah? So for instance, if you have an animal that's alive, and while it's alive, there's a restriction of Eivor Min Achai. After the animal is shechted, there can't be any more isur Eivor Min Achai, but there's a possibility of isur nevela, or a problem in the shechita. So what does the animal have then? What isur was associated with the animal before that you have a chazoka that's be'isur, that you need some evidence to prove that it's mutar now, to show the shechita is mutar? So that those that suggest, Rashi makes this comment in Chulin with regards to shechita, that the isur that was on the animal was Eivor Min Achai. And therefore you need shechita to be matir the Eivor Min Achai, or to take away the chezkat isur of Eivor Min Achai. The Balei Tosafot over there, others say, what's Rashi speaking about? Eivor Min Achai disappears as soon as the animal dies. So where is the isur there transferred or continued after the animal's dead? Once the animal's dead, there's no Eivor Min Achai to discuss. That chazaka is gone. So what you'd say is that Rashi believes, or simply is indicating, that if you have a chezkat isur of Eivor Min Achai, and it directly passes into isur nevela, we consider that to be a chazaka that's in place and remains in place. It's a rolling chazaka where you can pass the baton to the next isur. And in that way, if you believe that, and that's what seemingly the Rashbam says, because it says here, harihi b'chezkat isur adata. She had a chezkat isur. The chezkat isur until now was eshet ish. So now that rolls, in a sense, into the isur of marrying out or not forming yibum. And so since that isur rolls from eshet ish into the isur of marrying someone when you are b'zikat yibum, what we say is it carries trappings of that original isur. So even though you're talking about a lav now, since it derived from a chezkat eshet ish and derived from an isur chenek, we're going to now impose on the isur of lo tia eshet ameta chutz li ishzar, we're going to say about that it is a much higher form of isur. Even though on face, Right? It is just a lav, just like the lav of a kohen marrying a zonah is just a lav, but nevertheless, the origins of it and the derivatives of it were something that were much more chamor, and therefore we're going to assign it a much higher standing as an isur. It doesn't change the fact of what the punishment is, it just means that we will treat it with much more care and much more reticence in terms of being matir this isur. It's a very big chiddush of the Rishbam over here, but it's dictated by the Gemara. The Gemara says you're comparing zona or shvuya to eshadish. But there is no eshadish over here, so you have to give some explanation for what it means here, eshadish. You could argue, if you believe that the girsa, unlike Rishbam, of mishum denavla nafshul gabe shabai, is included here, then you could explain it, that reason applies by shvuya, and it's not relevant by eshadish, not eshadish literally, but by zikat yibum. And in that way, you could possibly solve the problem by just simply saying, the reason we're making by Shvuya is not relevant by us. And for that reason, you're not going to, even though it's not literally Eshet Ish. But again, you have to take it not literally. You have to say Lav Davka Eshet Ish. But in that way, you can avoid what the Rishbam is saying over here, that there's an Isur Chenek and there's an Isur Eshet Ish that is associated with this individual. Okay, for that reason, Rava again here says that we're chushla, that we worry about this comment of Abaye, and you're going to have to find these edim and clarify the situation, because again, like the Tosafot says, we have high suspicion that there are edim out there that have evidence or information that's important to the case. All right, so now we're going back to the Mishnah, where the individual declares somebody to be a brother, and the remaining brothers don't say anything, or don't know, or deny it. That was the question we have. If you remember in the Mishnah, it says that, we'll use the example that we used in the Mishnah, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Reuven and Shimon are brothers, and then Shimon comes along and says, Levi is also our brother. Reuven, we don't know what he says, but then the Mishnah said that in that case, Shimon's got to give a portion of his Yerusha to Levi because he declared him a brother. We also had the Mishnah say that if independent Yerusha falls to Levi, then all the brothers get to share in it. Reuven and Shimon get to share in that Yerusha. So that actually brought up a complex issue, which I mentioned in the Mishnah, which is on one hand, we're saying that Reuven is saying that he's not his brother, doesn't have to contribute towards the Yerusha. On the other hand, he's saying he is his brother because he's collecting the Yerusha from Levi. So how does that work? And that's the nature of the question of the Gemara here. Ze'achi enu ne'eman. If Shimon says Levi is our brother, he's not believed. V'idach ma'kamrei. Reuven, what is he saying? What is his response to Shimon saying that Levi is our brother? If he says, yeah, you know, he is our brother, why is it that you only take from Shimon to divide up the Yerusha? You should also take from Reuven. If Reuven admits that he's a brother, then you should divide up the Yerusha three ways, and all the parties will have to contribute towards Levi, not just Shimon. Elad Kamrei, it must be that he's saying, it must be that Reuven is denying that he is a brother. Shimon says, he is a brother, and Reuven says he's not our brother. That's why Shimon has to contribute out of his Yerusha to Levi, but Reuven doesn't. Ema Seifa. What are you going to do with the latter part of the Mishnah, which is, Naflu lo nechasim im makom acher? If the Levi inherits possessions not through their brotherhood, but from a different location, Yeshua Chavimo, all the brothers get to share in it. Reuven and Shimon get to share in it. Why does Reuven have any rights to share in here if he denied the brotherhood? Hamrei le lavachuno. You told me that it wasn't our brother, so why should he share in it? Lo tzricha, it's a case, the kamrei, ein anu yudim. Reuven says, I have no clue. I don't know. Shimon says, I know for sure Levi is our brother. Reuven says, I don't know if he's our brother. I don't have any information. So now, in a case where you're trying to extract from Reuven, hamotzimi chavero lavaraya, Reuven's going to say, look, if you prove me that he's a brother, I'll give up my Yerusha. But until then, I'm going to hold on to my Yerusha. Vice versa, if you say now that he is our brother and Levi got some Yerusha, then Reuven's going to say, look, I'm a party to this. You declared him our brother. Meaning Shimon, you said not only is he your brother, but he's our brother. And therefore, and thus you can prove otherwise, I should be entitled to a portion of that Yerusha. He's not denying it. And therefore, he should have a right to that Yerusha, just like Shimon has. So he's saying, I don't know, now opens up his benefit in both directions. He won't have to pay towards the Yerusha, but he will be a Yoresh if possessions fall to Levi. So Gemara says, Amar Rava, and others have the gifts of Amar Rava over here, says, Zot Omeret. From this conclusion that we just drew about what our Mishnah is saying, Mana li biyadecha, a person comes, a creditor comes and says, you owe me 100 zuz, Valomer, ini odeya. And the other party says, I don't know, Patur, he doesn't have to pay. This way is something that we saw together in the Gemara in Baba Kama and Daf Kuf Yud Chet. Over there we saw a Machloket Amoraim. And there we had Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda who say that you are Chayav. In a case where it's Bari Vishema, the creditor is coming with a Bari claim and the debtor is saying Shema, he says, I don't know. In that case, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda say you gotta pay up. Because the Bari governs, the Shema, you don't deny it. If you don't deny it, you gotta pay what you owe. Rav Nachman and Rav Yochanan say you are patur. Rav Nachman and Rav Yochanan say you're patur because any yodeya doesn't mean you're chayav, means any yodeya. Now, the Gemara over there says that he's patur, but he has to take a shvuat heseit. He has patur, but he doesn't have to take a regular shvuat, he just takes a shvuat heseit, which is the imposition of the chachamim, because the equivalent of a kofar bakol. That's what we deem him. We deem him to be a kofar bakol. Since he's a kofar bakol, he's subject to the regular rules of kofar bakol, which is a shvuat heseit. Now, we obviously paskin like Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman, because generally we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan versus any other Amora, and Rabbi Nachman, we paskin like him, bedinim. So now we have Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Nachman taking a single position, we're going to paskin like him. So now, you have a situation here where we have the equivalent case in our Mishnah. One brother, Shimon, says Levi is definitely our brother, he's making a Bari claim, and on the other hand, Reuven is saying Shema. I don't know if he is our brother. And over there we say that Reuven's not obligated to pay in to the Yerusha to Levi. It's the equivalent of him saying, you owe money. That's what Shimon's saying. You owe money to pay Levi for his Yerusha. And Reuven's saying, I don't know. And we're saying that he is patur. So if we say that he is patur in our Mishnah, that's supportive of the view of Rav Nachman and Rav Yochanan and the Gemara in Baba Kama. And that's what Rabbah is saying. From our Mishnah, you have evidence to support Rav Yochanan and Rav Nachman's position that you are patur. Rabbeinu Gershom says something interesting over here. He says, patur afilu mishvua. You're patur, and you don't even have to take a shvua. That's a little strange, because generally we would say that he'd have to take a shvua to a saint. Here, the Rabbeinu Gershom is suggesting that what Rabbah is saying is, not only is it not like Rav Yehuda and Rav Huna, it's not even like Rav Nachman and Rav Yochanan, because they require shvua to a saint. Over here, our Mishnah seems to indicate you're patur legamre. Reuven has to do absolutely nothing over here. He doesn't have to take a shvua, and he doesn't have to pay in. So he's completely exonerated in this case, or he's completely freed of the obligation in this case. So we should use this Mishnah to bring evidence as to what the ruling will be in a case of Bari and Shema. Now, over here, the Balei Tosafot bring a distinction that they also bring in the Gemara and Baba Kama. There's a very large Tosafot over there in Daf Kuf Yud Chet, which Tosafot discusses this issue of Bari v'Shema. Over there, he distinguishes between different types of Bari and Shema. He says that it's not conclusive that anytime you have a Bari and Shema, that the din will always be the same. That's because it depends on the Bari and it depends on the Shema. Bari, when you make a definitive claim, there are two types of claims you can make. You can make a definitive claim because it makes sense that you have the information. Or you can make a definitive claim because you think that that's the way it went, or you are surmising that that's the way it went. The same is true in the response of a Shema. The same is true when somebody gives a response of maybe. It could be maybe, but he should have known the information. He's saying maybe, which is problematic, because why doesn't he know the information? Or it could be a maybe because there's really no way for him to know the information. The distinction brought is in a case of milveh. Case of debt, then when the creditor says bari, that's a strong bari, because it makes sense that the creditor knows that he lent them the money and that he owes them the money. When the debtor says, I don't know, that's a very weak, I don't know, because he should know whether he borrowed money or he didn't borrow money. He should be able to say, I did or I didn't borrow the money. In that case, the Bari will trump the Shema. In a case, the other case that's there in the Gemara Baba Kama, is in a case where there was a purchase, and then the cow gave birth, and we don't know whether the birth was in the possession of the buyer or the seller. Over there, when the guy comes and makes a definitive claim, he says, it was definitely born when it was in my possession, and the other guy says, Shema, what do we expect from him? He can't know, he wasn't there at the time. So his Shema is not really as a weak a Shema, and the Bari claim is not even as a strong a Bari claim. How does he know for certain that when it happened? Well, if he does know, the other party doesn't have to know, and the Shema is not a strong Shema. So Tosafot makes that distinction and says that Bari and Shema that we're speaking about here, where we say that you are Chayav because of the Bari, or you would possibly say you're a Patur, might revolve around these different types of Bari and Shema. But what he points out is that despite the fact that that distinction exists, we're going to see here that the Gemara blurs those lines and doesn't deal with it at all. And he says that Abaye over here ignores that distinction, and that will explain Abaye's position many places in Shas, where we have certain inconsistencies in the position of Rabbi Yehuda. But sometimes Rabbi Yehuda says Patur, sometimes it says Chayav. So you could explain it according to the distinction that Tosafot made, depending on what type of Bari and Shema we're speaking about. Or he suggests over here that Abaye ignores that distinction. And therefore Abaye is quoted as being the Bala Memra, it quotes Rabbi Yehuda in certain places, because Tosafot says it's premised on this idea that Abaye makes no such distinction over here between the type of Bari and the type of Shema that there is. But it's important that Tosafot, because of that distinction he makes, it's important not just to one brushstroke say that all Bari and Shema are the same. There are different types of Bari and different types of Shema, and you have to look at the context in order to understand that. All right, so now he's Abaye Amar. Abaye rejects this idea proposed by either Rava or Rabba and says, the Olam Emlecha Chayav. I'm going to say that he is Chayav. Vishani Ocha. And over here it's different. Dichamanel Acher Biyadcha Dami. It's as if someone comes along and says, oh, this person owes you 100 zuz. So the scenario would be that you have a creditor and a debtor. The creditor doesn't say anything. Another third party comes along and says that the debtor owes the creditor money. He owes him 100 zuz. The debtor says, I don't know. In that case, the bari of the third party has no impact on the debtor saying maybe, because he's lav bal dvarim didiat. You're not a relevant party to the case. Your statement has no bearing here because you're not a party to the case. Similarly over here, and you have to intuit this, Rabbeinu Gershom says it explicitly, which is, v'zeatzmo en yodea imachirem hu. That Levi in this case also doesn't know whether he's a brother. So you have three brothers here. You have Reuven, Shimon, who are known to be brothers, and Levi, who's this outside party that Shimon declares to be his brother. So Shimon says, Levi is definitely our brother. Reuven says, I don't know. So that's why Rabba or Rova considered to be a Bari and a Shema, and Reuven is Patur. Abaye says that's not correct. Because Levi, what does Levi say in this case? Levi also says maybe. Levi says, I don't know if I'm a brother. Shimon declares him a brother, but Levi himself doesn't know, and Reuven doesn't know. So now Reuven's gonna say, when Shimon comes along and says he's definitely our brother, you gotta pay in, you gotta give a contribution over here. Reuven says, La bal dvarim didiat. You're not a party to this case. If Levi comes with a definitive claim, maybe you'll be chayav. That'd be a bari and a shema, and he would have to pay out. But over here, since Levi himself doesn't know, there's no claimant that has a definitive claim. It's a shema and shema case, and therefore, that's why you're patur over here. You're patur over here because there's no bari claim. Had there been a bari claim, then maybe we would have said that you are chayav, and therefore it's not a disproof of those positions that say chayav, because this case is different. This is not the case of bari and shema. This is where the Balei Tosafot say that obviously Abaye ignores this idea or differentiation between Bari and Shema. Because over here, he's saying that you're Chayav, despite the fact that the Bari and Shema over here are difficult Bari and Shema. Could be that Shimon knows for sure that Levi is their brother, but when Reuven says, I don't know, that's not a problematic statement. Why should Reuven know that Levi's his brother? Until now, they had no idea he was his brother, and why should he have to know that information? It's actually a weak Shema, and maybe even a weak Bari. And in that case, even Rabbi Yehuda might agree that you are Patur, and it would not undermine his position. What you see from Abaye over here is he doesn't think that that happens, and that Rabbi Yehuda will say Bari v'Shema is Chayav in all cases. No distinction between the type of Bari and the type of Shema, the context of the Bari and Shema that is being said over here. That's what Abaye is saying. It's subject to the Machloket of Bari v'Shema, whether you pass in Chayav or Patur. The Mishnah is not dealing with that case. That case would be subject to Machlot Amoraim as to whether Bari V'Shem is Chayav or Bari V'Shem is Patur. Bari Rova. So Rova asked the following question. Shevach Sheshibchu Nichasim Me'alehem. In a situation where Levi passes away, and now he had assets from another situation, we said in the Mishnah that those assets go to Reuven and Shimon. They get split evenly between the brothers, because as far as Shimon's statement, Levi is the one that Shimon says is our brother. Reuven says, I don't know if he's our brother. If Levi gets assets and now he passes away, Reuven and Shimon split the assets. Shimon himself doesn't get to keep it all because he admits that Reuven and he are both brothers. And since Reuven says, I don't know, there's no reason Shimon can take the assets away from Reuven and say they're all mine now because I'm the only one who admits that he's our brother. So, Bai Rava, Shevach Sheshibchu Nichasim Me'alehem Mahu. If the Nichasim appreciated by themselves, what is the din? So here you have a situation in which Shimon contributed assets to Levi. Again, in the scenario that we had, there were three parcels that the father had. He passed away. Had it only been Reuven and Shimon, each of them would have gotten 1.5 of the parcels. Had there been three brothers, they'd each get one parcel. But here we have a problem because Reuven says, I don't know. Shimon says we have a brother, Levi. So in that case, Reuven keeps his 1.5. Shimon gets his 1.5, and he says to give a half of it to Levi, because that's his contribution towards Levi. In that case, Levi will have half a parcel, Shimon will have one parcel, and Reuben will have 1.5 parcels, and that will be the division. That half parcel that was given to Levi, it goes up in value. It appreciates in value. Now that it appreciates in value, who's entitled to that appreciation? Is the appreciation only belong to Shimon, because he's the one who contributed that asset to Levi? Or do we say that the appreciation is the equivalent of third-party assets coming to Levi? And since it's third-party assets coming to Levi, then Reuven's also entitled to it. So the question is, that appreciation, does it only go back to Shimon, like the underlying property, which definitely only goes back to Shimon? Or does it also go to Reuven because anything in excess of the base property that Shimon gave is split by all the brothers, including Reuven and Shimon? So that's the nature of Rava's question. Shevach sheshibuk nesim le'em ma'u. What's the din? B'shevach ha'magi ala ketfayim. If you're talking about shevach that gets to the shoulders, loti ba'ilach, then you have no question. D'chei naflu lo nechassim m'makom acher dami. They are clearly considered to be like third-party assets. Now, what is the meaning of shevach nechassim that magi ala ketfayim? That is a machloket in the Rishonim that is brought a little bit over here by the Rashbam, but we actually saw back in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, as well as the Tosafot on Daf Mem Bet Amud Aleph, brings this machloket that is found throughout Shas, and he says, Mifaresh Rashi, Bekama Mikomot, V'chein Rabbeinu Shmuel, and so too the Rashbam, Demagila Ketfayim, Kigon Anavim Aruim Libatzer. It's talking about items that are ready to be picked, items that don't need the karka anymore. They no longer need to be attached to the karka. They are attached to the karka, but they don't need to be attached to the karka. They're considered to be separate entities from the karka. So that would be the definition over here. And you can see that as well in the Rabbeinu Gershom. Although the Rashbam over here gives the alternate explanation, which is what his brother, the Rabbeinu Tam, says. The Rabbeinu Tam says that Shevach HaMagia LeKetfayim is Hainu Davar Shebayu De Torach. Something that you have to put your shoulders into. Something you have to put work into. So it doesn't matter whether it is or isn't finished. It's a matter of whether the appreciation came from your input. You put your sweat into this, and that's why there is Shevach over here. So the Bali Tosafot back on Membet, Amud Bet, when they speak about this, weigh the different options, and our Gemara plays heavily in that as to whether Rashi's explanation or the Rabbeinu Tam's explanation is better. In the Tosafot in Bava Metzia, he brings a third possibility of a Shevach Magia LeKetfayim, which is something that you carry off the field. It might be a derivative of the others, but it's something that you put on your shoulders and carry off the field. So that's anything that's movable, or any object that can be taken off the field is considered to be Shevach HaMagia LeKetfayim. So now, why is that relevant over here? Because if you're speaking about Shevach, the way that the Rabbeinu Tam says, and the Rashbam says the same thing over here, is that he put work into it. Levi did work and appreciated the asset. Shimon can't have a claim on that because Shimon didn't create that. He gave him the underlying property, but he didn't give him the appreciation or the value that was created through his work. That's the equivalent of a third-party asset coming in, and therefore Reuven can split equally with Shimon in that asset because that's not Shimon's asset. So that's what the Gemara says definitively. That's about Shevach HaMagia LeKetfayim. If you believe like Rashi, it's Omedli Batzer. It's something that can be taken off or picked off the tree now because it no longer needs the ground. Similarly, you would say over here, it doesn't need the ground anymore. Since it doesn't need the ground, it's not considered to be a part of the karka. If it's not part of the karka, then it doesn't go back to Shimon. That's a third-party asset equivalent, and it'd be split between Reuven and Shimon. So now, kiti ba'yilach, where is there a question? The shevach she'enu magia leketfayim. When it is shevach that does not reach the shoulders, kigon. And now it gives example. Now this is the gears of the Rashbam, which is dikla va'alim, Arav Aska Sirton. This is something we just saw back on Daf Kuf Chaf Dalid, which is a tree that grew. It just continued to grow. It got bigger, it got thicker, and it continued to grow. Or there was a flood, and the flood washed up good earth or a good fertilizer onto the field and actually caused the field to be better. Over there, mine. What do we say there? Do we say that that is default appreciation? It's something that naturally happened to the field and therefore should belong to Shimon because he gave him the field and therefore it should belong to Shimon. Or do we consider it to be appreciation up and above the value or the underlying field? And given that, it would belong to both Reuven and Shimon. My, what's the din? Take it, we leave that as unresolved. The Rabbeinu Tam or the Bali Tosafot bring this as a proof to the Rabbeinu Tam's position over there that you see that Shevach She'enu Magia LeKetfayim is something that happens by itself, implying that Shevach HaMagia LeKetfayim is something that you invest in, something that you put work into, And therefore they want to see this as a proof to Rabbeinu Tam. But there the Balei Tosafot bring that it's not necessarily true. Because look at the first line in the Gemara, it says, Shevach Sheshibchu Nechasim Me'alehem. The Gemara gives a different term called Shevach that happens by itself. How come the Gemara didn't call it Shevach Sheinu Megeid LeKadfayim from the outset? That seems to indicate that Shevach Sheinu Megeid LeKadfayim is not synonymous with Nechasim that appreciate by themselves. And that way would be more supportive of Rashi's view. So depending on what you have, again here in the Girsa, in terms of Shevach Eina Magia the Ketfayim, whether that is what's saying over here, or Samuel and Kiti Bailach skip the words Shevach Sheinu Magia the Ketfayim, could go and Diklav Alim Arav Aska Sirton, that would avoid that problem, because it would not be defining Shevach Sheinu Magia the Ketfayim. So there are both Girsot over here, but it does have influence, this Gemara over here, you can see that in the Tosafot back on Mem Bet Amud Bet, over what you think Shevach HaMagia the Ketfayim is, and how it fits in better with the story over here, as well as the Gemara back on Mem Bet, how does it fit into the situation over there. All right, next Mishnah. Mishamait, benimtzeit daideki kishura al yerecho. Person passed away, and we find a last will and testament tied around his waist. Harizo eina klum. That is nothing. We do not abide by it. We do not worry about it. So as the Rashbam points out, the Chiddush is here, even though it seems in all likelihood that he wrote it, because otherwise why would it be wrapped around his loins or tied to him? Elaim Cain, he was the one who gave this tzava'ah, or he was the one who wrote it, and therefore we should have thought it should be binding. The failure over here is for one of two reasons. The way the Gemisha is going to give is because he was not mizakeh in it. He did not have a zikui in it. The Rashbam sees that very literally and says you need a kinyan. You need a kinyan in order for this shtar, this last will and testament, to be effective. So here in the Reisha, there was no kinyan. Since there's no kinyan, it's not effective. And that's why it fails, because the shtar would only go effective after he dies. And you can't have a shtar pass Yerusha after death. Everything has to be done before the death. And so therefore the kinyan would only take place after death, and that kinyan's not valid after death. The latter half of the Mishnah we'll see in a second is Zika, is a case where he gives it, and according to the Rashbam means that there was a kinyan. And that kinyan makes it that the last will and testament is effective. And the Rashbam in explaining that says, Da'afagav de tzavat shiv meira kone lachar mita, even though a tzava of a shiv meira works after death, and that's what the Chameim empowered him to do, that he can make a statement, and it only go effective after his death, ha'ni mile k'dei shelo titaref da'ato alav. That is an institution of the Chachamim, so that he should die peacefully and not worry about these things. When you write it into a shtar, which is unnecessary, it does not have the same power as his oral instructions that are his tzavat shkemira. He did not finish off the gifting until the shtar is given to the other party. And there's no shtar after his death. So here the Rashbam makes a big distinction between a tzavat shkemira, which is done verbally, orally, where it's binding on the spot, even though it's only effective after death, that's the institution of the Chachamim, versus a tzavat shkemira that is written down, and being written down, it's only effective if the shtar is given to the other party. But if it's not given to the other party, it won't be effective because that's not the normal way, or that wasn't the institution of the Chachamim. And you can't give it after the death, and therefore, since it wasn't given before the death, it fails. That's the view of the Rishbam. The other view in the Rishonim is not that there was actually a failure in the Kinyan over here, but rather there is a failure of a recipient. We don't know who he is giving it to. So we need him to give the shtar to someone in order to know who the someone is, who is the relevant party to the tzavat shkemira, or what's written in the document. So in the ratio of the Mishnah, the failure is that we don't have a recipient. And since we don't know who the recipient is, we're not going to rely on it. Or even if we do know who the intended recipient is, he might have changed his mind, and that's why it's still with him and not with the recipient, and therefore we can't make any assumptions in this situation. Whereas in the Sefer of the Mishnah, Zikaba, somebody took possession of it, and in taking possession of it, they become the rightful party or the rightful heir to whatever's written in this Tzavat Shchemera. There is an in-between view in the Sefer of the Mishnah, which is Zikaba, which is that someone took possession of it on behalf of someone else. So it'd be like the Rashbam that you need a kinyan, not necessarily that the individual is receiving it needs to do the kinyan, but someone can do the kinyan on his behalf by accepting it on his behalf. So we had the first half of the Mishnah, and that's why we said eino klum, that when he find the tzavat shkemira around his body, it's nothing. The zikah ba'al acher, if he gave it over to the other party, ben min ha'yorshim, whether that party is one of his yorshim, ben she'eino min ha-yorshim, whether it's not one of the yorshim, dvarav kayamim, then whatever is written in that document is binding. So according to the Rishbam, over here you made up for the deficit of a lack of a kinyan, because here there is a kinyan. You gave it over to a party who then made a kinyan on the item. From that, Rashbam, it sounds like it's the recipient who's making the kinyan, the one who is the giftee over here is making the kinyan. According to the other Rishonim, it is the fact that Zika, he gave it to the party. Now we know who the recipient is because he gave it to the party, and that's why it's effective in the seifa and not in the reisha. And we said before that there's an in-between opinion that says Zika is that he gave it to a party to accept on behalf of the recipient, and therefore it forms the kinyan that the Rishbam requires, not necessarily by giving it to the recipient, by giving it to a party who accepts it on behalf of who would the recipient would be. Now Gemara says, Tarabanan. Ezehi Daidaki. The Mishnah mentions this term Daidaki. What is a Daidaki? Kol shekatuv ba, any document in which it's written, da tehei the mekam viliyot. This will be forever and put into effect. It's a language that says that this is the way that things should be. This is my last will and testament. Now the way that the Rashbam reads it is that you literally have to have these words in it. Without these words in it, it's not called, it's avat shkemera. These words or this language is the boilerplate language that needs to be there. Otherwise, it's not classified as a tzvat shkimera. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Tam and others suggest that it doesn't literally mean that it has to have this language in there. This language is, as he calls it, a siman tov. Says that this should be in forever, but hopefully I won't die. That's kind of what he means by the language. But it's just a language that's a nice way to say it. But any tzavat shchemera that writes down whatever he said, that would be called a tzavat shchemera. The language itself isn't so important. More and more important is how it's done, meaning that this person's on his deathbed and he's writing or giving instructions in the document. We don't take it literally. Be'ezuhi matana, and what's considered to be a gift? Kol shekatuba me'ayom ula'achar mita. Any document in which it says, from today until after I die. Ma'as elameyom la'achar mitahu davya matana. The only way to grant a gift is to use the language of from today until after I die. Me'achshav lo avya matana. If he says immediately, this is a gift, that's not considered to be a gift. Why do you have to use the lashon of mayom la'achar mita? Me'achshav would be just as effective in passing a matanah, even more effective because it happens immediately. It's effective immediately. So Amar Abaye Yochi Kamar. This is what's meant by this braita. Ezehi matanat bari, sheik matnat shchemera. What type of matana of a bari functions in the same way that a matana of a shchemera works? To lo kani el alachar mita, that it only goes effective after death. Kol shekatuba me'ayom ulachar mita. Anything which has written in it from today until achar mita. So now, how does that work? The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom writes it is, Yatchil matana zo sheber shutcha, it will begin to be in your possession from today, umigamer loti gamer el alachar mita, but it will only be completed after death. So the way the Rabbeinu Gershom views it, it seems to be like it's a kinyan that extends over a long period of time. It starts today and only ends at the time of achar mita, but it's a kinyan that is processed over all that time, or only goes effective over that whole time. The Rashbam over here, on the other hand, says, Me'olom achar mita means that today, from this moment, the underlying property is yours, but the peirot, the output of the property, will not be yours until I die. So I'm giving you principal ownership in the property today, but that principal ownership will have no bearing and no meaning to you until I die, because then you'll own the output of the karka. So it has two parts to it. It has the underlying principal, which is gifted me'ayom, and the achar mita is then you will get the rights to the peirot associated with this karka. So now you have ownership, but that ownership is meaningless because you don't have the output rights. Once I die, you also have the output rights associated with it. That's the way the Rashbam writes it. But given that, that means that the Rashbam thinks you cannot reverse it. That means that the kinyan is completely affected today with no ability to retract it. Because mi'ayom, from today, you have an absolute kinyan in the principle of the property. We're just waiting for the peirot aspect of it, but the principle's done. And that means that he can't change his mind later, he can't upend it. According to the Rabbeinu Gershom, where it spans over time, there's a possibility that you could interrupt that kinyan. You said the kinyan runs from today until achar mita, you could do something in between that stops the kinyan, or you give someone else a kinyan immediately, maybe that would give them a competing right. The Rabbeinu Tam in the Balei Tosafot over here says something similar to that. He says that even though what the Rashbam is saying is true, that many other places, including a Mishnayot that are coming up, where you use the term Yom HaMitah, works that way. It means that the principle today, the payroll later. Nevertheless, that's not the meaning over here. Mayom lachamita means over here, and this is what the Rabbeinu Tam says. For Eish Rabbeinu Tam, mayom lachamita, I know mayom, im lo echzor bo ad achar mita. The kinyan is effective today, as long as I don't change my mind before I die. Umayri, if you go and sheperish, beperish, mayom, im lo echzor ad achar mita. He says that you have to say that explicitly, which is that it's good from today, assuming that I don't change my mind before I die. The mistama, because if he just said the default, mayom lachar mita, have mayom kane gufo lachar mita kane perot. He agrees with the Rashbam. If you just use the simple language of Mayom Akramita, it has the effect of making the principle today and the payroll later on. But he says that's not the way to read this Gemara. It doesn't make sense in this Gemara, because here you're trying to have a Matnat Bari that looks like a Matnat Shchiv Meira. Matnat Shchiv Meira has two aspects to it, or two characteristics to it, that make it a Matnat Shchiv Meira. Number one is that it's only effective at the time of death. And number two is that you can retract it any time. You can supersede it with another Matnat Shchiv Meira. So if I want to create a matnat bari that's similar, then that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says. You have to say the languages here. It's effective today if I don't change my mind before I die. So now, if he changes his mind before he die, he can upend it, like a matnat shchimera. And if he doesn't change his mind, then at the time of death, it goes effective back to me'ayom. So that would work just like a matnat shchimera. And so for that reason, the Rabbeinu Tam interprets me'ayom achamita differently in this situation than most cases that it's found in Shas. Yoti rabba baravuna baksajud beirav. So Rabbi Ravuna was in the Beit Midrash. I don't think you can literally read it here, Bei Rav, as being that of Rav. Because we're going to see the story has participants that are in Eretz Yisrael. As Rabbi Ravuna, Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Yochanan are all Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael. So why would they be in the Beit Midrash of Rav? Seems unlikely, and therefore, Achsad de Bei Rav means that he was in the Beit Midrash. Yodim Kamar Mishmei de Rabbi Yochanan, and he said over in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Shchimera Sheamar. Shchimera that says, Kitzvu Utsnu Maneh Leploni, says, go ahead and write down and give 100 zuz to so-and-so, umate. And he dies before they actually write the contract, before they write the shtar. Ein kotvim v'notim. You don't write it and give it. Shema lo gamar laknoto ela bishtar. Because from his statement, it makes it sound like he's not giving this as a matnat shkemera, but he's giving it rather through the vehicle of a shtar. Vein shtar lachar mita. And the shtar cannot be effective after he dies. Because he said to them, kitvu, write it, utsno, and then give it. So the writing makes it sound like he wants the gift not to be given through the normal vehicle of matnat shchimera. We can just verbalize it, articulate it, and it'd be fine. Sounds like he wants you to write it down. And the writing it down makes it, not that he wants it written down so that he has evidence of the fact that he said it, but it sounds like he wants it being written down in order that that be the mechanism for granting the gift. If that's the case, the shtar would have to reach the other individual, or at least someone would have to accept it on his behalf, before the person passed away. Over here, they didn't even write it before he passed away. And therefore, it's not considered to be a shtar or a good sivoy, and the person does not receive the gift. Now, the Rashbam qualifies this and says that only if he dies do you not write it down, implying that if he didn't die, we would have written it down. The whole problem is that he already died, and we can't write the shtar, the achar mitah. But if we were able to write the shtar before mitah and give it to the individual, that we would write the shtar and it's fine. There are other Rishonim who disagree with that and say that even if he doesn't die, we don't write it down. Because the way that a matnat shchimera works is that it's only effective at the point of death. And a shtar is not effective at that point in time. A shtar is just not a mechanism for matnat shchimera. And if the shchimera is thinking that this shtar is the vehicle for the kinyan, it will only be effective after mitah, and that doesn't work. So therefore, we don't write it down, period. Whether he dies before we write it down, or whether he dies after we've written it down, we won't give it to the individual, because this is not an effective mechanism for giving the last will and testament of a shchimera, because the Chachamim instituted how a matnat shchimera works, and it was a limited scope, because it's overriding what otherwise are the lochot midorait and regular kinyanim. And that scope only dealt with the articulation by the Shchimera, not something that is done through a contract or the writing down in a kinyan. Amar lehu Rabbi Elazar is daruba. So Rabbi Elazar, who's a Talmid of Rabbi Yochanan, Talmid Chaver of Rabbi Yochanan, says, you should listen to what Rabbi Yochanan says. What Rabbi Yochanan says is the halacha. Rav Shizvi, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amra. So Rav Shizvi has a different version of the story, which is that Rabbi Elazar said the memra. He's the one who said that if the Shemira said, write it down and give it, that if he dies before you write it down and give it, you don't give it. V'amralu Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan said to the Talmidim there, Izdaruba, you should listen to Rabbi Elazar. Amar Nachman Rabbi Yitzchak, Kavate the Rav Shizvi Mistabra. The version of the story brought by Rav Shizvi seems to make more sense than the story that we brought originally. If you say that Rabbi Elazar was the one who was the Bala Memra, he's the one who said over this din about the Shemira, it's the Rabbi Yochanan Nasudeale, to Rabbi Elazar. That makes sense then that Rabbi Yochanan was backing up or giving his stamp of approval to Rabbi Elazar's statement. It's his Rebbe. It's Rabbi Yochanan who carries huge weight. He's giving a stamp of approval to what Rabbi Elazar said. Eli Amar Rabbi Yochanan Amra, if you say the other way around, that Rabbi Yochanan is the one who said it, it's true, Rabbi Elazar, Sude Alei, the Rabbi Yochanan Rabbe. Why does Rabbi Elazar have to testify or give a stamp of approval to that which his Rebbe said? Rabbi Elazar's stamp of approval does nothing when it's talking about his Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan, and therefore, what would it be meaningful that Rabbi Elazar is saying, Istaruba, be careful with this din of Rabbi Yochanan. And therefore, we favor Rav Shizvi's version of the story, Ve'od, Tashma. And another reason to say this is, the Rabbi Elazar Amra. I have another proof that Rabbi Elazar was the author of the Memra. The Shalach Ravin Mishmeid Rabbi Abahu. Ravin says in the name of Rabbi Abahu, Hava Yodim, Shalach Rabbi Elazar the Gola. You should know that Rabbi Elazar sent to the Gola, to Bavel, Mishum Rabbeinu, in the name of Rabbeinu. Now, what's interesting over here is both the Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Gershom say, Mishum Rabbeinu over here is Rav, in the name of Rav. That's interesting because Rabbi Elazar is in Eretz Yisrael, and he's sending to the Gola in the name of Rav. So that's interesting. How did Rabbi Elazar have a Mesorah from Rav if he's in Eretz Yisrael and he's trying to send it back to Bavel? Seems unlikely. Mishum Rabbeinu would more likely be Rabbi Yochanan, who's the Rebbe of Rabbi Elazar. Because Rabbi Yochanan himself barely saw Rav when Rav was in Eretz Yisrael. Certainly his Talmid, Rabbi Elazar, probably had no connection to Rav in Eretz Yisrael. Eliam Kenyu said that they had a Memra that he was saying over from Rav that he had heard in the name of Rav, and he was repeating it, because otherwise it'd be hard to understand why Rabbi Elazar is saying over a memra in the name of Rav. Be that as it may, the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rashbam both say here that Rabbeinu means Rav. So Ravin brought from Rabbi Yabal in Eretz Yisrael that Rabbi Elazar in Eretz Yisrael sent to the Gola in the name of Rav the following memra. Shchiv meira shamar kitvu tnu maneh leploni umeit ein kotvim notim. Shema lo gamar laknoto elo bishtar vein shtar lachar mita. So here you have it explicitly told in another memra or another story that Rabbi Elazar was the one who sent to the Gola that this memra. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Tivadek. Rabbi Yochanan says, you need to look into it. You need to check into it. So that's interesting because before Rabbi Yochanan backed up Rabbi Elazar's statement. All of a sudden over here we have Rabbi Yochanan saying, yeah, you have to check into it. So my Tivadek. What does it mean that you have to check into it? Kiata Rav Dimi Amar. So when Rav Dimi came and said, Daideki Mivatelet Daideki. A tzavat shchimera can undermine another tzavat shchimera. That the shchimera has a right to change his mind. And as long as he's still alive, he can continue to change his mind and change the daidiki and give a new shtar or give a new instructions about what he wants to happen. Rashba makes it clear over here that shchimera, shekatav nechasav la'acher, a person who writes his possessions to another party, V'chasar, v'katav, and then he went ahead and changed his mind and wrote it to someone else. Rishon, lo kana. Sharei shchimera has a right to change his mind. But the Rashbam qualifies that and says, v'dafka b'ktiva, that's only if it's written, below zikui, without a zchia, without a kinyan being made over here. So the Rashbam, similar to his position before, sees the kinyan being an integral part of this, the shchimera gifting through a shtar. And therefore, the Rashbam says, as long as there's no kinyan yet by the recipient, then the shchimera has a right to change his mind. Right, the Rashbam over here says, daf u'ktiba b'lo zikui, and later on in daf kufnu bet amud bet, there the Rashbam defines zika, similar to what he does over here, which means the misira. It was given over to the other party. Over there, the Bali Tosafot think that that's not sufficient grounds to lock you into a matnat shchimera simply because you gave over the document to the party. But rather, you need some sort of formalized kinyan. That you say, I was makne the item to you, adiyei acher. Or leik chazek uknei. You have to do a real formal type of kinyan on the nechasim, on the properties, in order for this to be a binding daidiki that cannot be undermined by another daidiki. And there, Rav and Shmuel argue as to what the status of the second Matnat Shchemira is in that case. According to Rav, once you have the formalized Kinyan involved, it becomes like a Matnat Bari, and therefore you cannot reverse it. Shmuel says that it still remains a Matnat Shchemira, and since it's a Matnat Shchemira, the next Matnat Shchemira can undermine it, even when you have Katav Vizika, Katav Vizika. So that's the first statement. According to the Rishbam, this has no bearing on the previous statements. That's just two memorot that were brought. The first memor is not relevant to us. The second one is the Tivadek, which is Shchemira Shamar Kitvu Tnuman Ela Ploni Umet. A Shchemira that says, write and give this gift to so-and-so, but he dies. So now, over here, Rabbi Elazar said, that's it. It's over. You don't give the gift. Over here, we have a different thing, which is Roim. Im Kemiyapet Kocho Kosvim. If he was just trying to strengthen his claim, then we write it. Vim lav in kotvim. But if not, we don't write it. And then the Gemara in a second will ask, what does that mean? Miyape kochol. So here you have a statement, Rabbi Yochanan, that says you have to check the intentions of the party. So Rabbi Yochanan does agree with Rabbi Lazar that if the person instructed kidvut, no, write it and give it, that we assume that it wasn't given if it wasn't written before the death of that individual, because you can't have a shtar achar mita. Rabbi Yochanan says you need to clarify first why he wanted a shtar. If he wanted a shtar and simply to strengthen the statement that he made, he wants to gift it to him and he wants evidence of that. So he gives the shtar to be just the shtar raya, but not the kinyan. The kinyan is done through the articulation, the verbalization by the shchemera. In that case, you can write it down because the kinyan happened immediately when he said it, when he instructed them to give it to him. On the other hand, if you see that the reason that he said kidvut, no, was because he wanted that to be the mechanism for the kinyan, then you can't give it to him because there's no kinyan, achamitan, the shtar wasn't there before the guy died for the recipient to receive it and have that kinyan before death. So that's what Rabbi Yochanan says over here. So then, Meitiv Rabbi Avraham Mamel, Bari Shamar kidvut, no, manel aplonio mate, a Bari that says, write it and give it to so-and-so and then dies, ein kodvim benotinin. You do not then go ahead and write it and give it to him. Hashchemera. The inference you would draw from this is that's only true by a bari. But a shchemera kodvim v'notanim. By a shchemera we would write it and give it even lachar mita, even after he died. Hu motivla v'hu mefarikla. He asked the question, he answered himself. B'miyapet kochol. That's a case where he's just giving the shtar as evidence to back up or give him more strength in the kinyan that he had. So therefore we say by the case of Kitvu Tznuman El Aploni, where it's a case of a Bari, over there, without the Kinyan, there's no reason to be Miyapet Kocho because there was no granting. The gift never happened. Unless there's a Kinyan on the gift, the Shtar is meaningless. Or there, the Shtar has to be to make the Kinyan because otherwise what made the transaction effective? Since there's no effective transaction, there's no reason to write a Shtar to back it up. On the other hand, by a Shchemera, where through his articulation and verbalization, there's already a Kinyan, then their writing of the Shtar could be a backup document, and that's why it's allowed to be written even after death, because then it's solely as a Shtar Raya, not a Shtar Kinyan. So by the Bari, you need a Shtar Kinyan, and that's why you can't write it after death. By the Shchemera, it could be a Shtar Kinyan, or it could be a Shtar Raya. What we'll say is that it was a Shtar Raya in this case, and that's why you can write it even after the death, and that's the Diuk, out of that braita. So Gemara says, Hechi dami miyapet kocho. How do you know whether the says kitvutz nu means write something down just to give him more power, to bring evidence to the fact that he was gifted this, versus just simply saying he wants the shtar to be the mechanism for gifting the gift? Kedamar of chista, v'kinyona minei mosifa matnata do. It's a case where he says that he had a kinyan from me, Mosif al-Matnatado, adding on top of the gift that I had given to him. Further on, this is a case where a Shchemira, who writes all of his possessions to a party, and there was a kinyan from him, if he gets better and walks away from this death sentence, and he survives, then he can reverse all that was given. All the matanot that were given, he can reverse them, because there's an umdanadat. There's an automatically implicit in his gifts. He's only giving them away because he's going to die. If he doesn't die, then there's a reversal of all those gifts. But if he dies, the matana goes through and the matana shchemera is effective. Even though he wrote a kinyan in that matana shchemera, we don't say maybe he didn't intend to give it as a matana shchemera, but rather as a kinyan through the shtar. And ain't shtar l'achar mita, therefore it should not be an effective gift. In order to explain that, Rav Chisda says, that when do we say that a kinyan in a shtar does not detract from the matnat shchemira is when the kinyan is written as a hosafa, as an additional item on top of the matnat shchemira. And that's what he says, kinyan amina musif amatnata da, that this kinyan adds on to the gift that I am giving. So in essence, the gift was given through the tzavat shchemira, and then the shtar, or the kinyan of the shtar, is simply evidence or a bonus on top of that. And that's what makes the gift effective. But Rav Chisda says over here that the shtar is not a shtar to make the kinyan. The shtar is just miyapek kocho. It's only something that is there to evidence the gift. And the shtar is just a shtar raya, or a miyapek kocho. So also over here, dhachanami damar af tovu v'chatomu. Just like over there, where Rav Chisda says the language or the kinyan means mosif amatnadada. It's to add on. It's an extra. It's a benefit to this party above and beyond the kinyan that you have. Which means that the shtar itself is not the kinyan, but it's just evidence of the kinyan. So to over here, if he uses the word af, af ktovu v'chatomu, also write it down and sign it, v'havulei, and then give it to him, that's also miyapek kocho. As the Rashbam points out, it doesn't matter if he said kitvu, tnu, or tnu v'kitvu, the order of the language of the verbs here does not make a difference. The only thing that makes a difference is if he adds in the word af. And that's the only thing that will sway us to believe that it was miyapek kocho, and the shtar itself wasn't the vehicle for the acquisition. Because he used the word af, it means that this is in addition to. It's not the mechanism for kinyan, it's an additional piece of evidence to the gift. And in that way, he is showing or demonstrating that it is miyape et kocho. Itmar, Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Alocha Kotvim V'Notnim. Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel says, in that case, you write it and give it. V'chein Amar Rava, Amar Rav Nachman, Alocha Kotvim V'Notnim. In those cases, the achar mita, we will give it to him and we will write it down. Like Rabbi Yochanan says over here, because it is miyapeh et kocho, when you use language that indicates that the writing of the document is only an additional piece of evidence, but not the mechanism for the kinyan, then we will say that you can write it even after death. But of course, if he doesn't say that, he just simply says, kitvu, tnu, write it and give it, then over there we assume that he might have meant to give it through the kinyan of the shtar, en shtar lachar mita, and like Rabbi Lazar says, and Rabbi Yochanan agrees, then the halach is, we don't give the gift and we don't write it down then, because we're uncertain as to what the mechanism of kinyan was. So in a case where we know that it was miyapek kocho, because he says this is in addition to whatever was done already, then we say you can write it after death. On the other hand, if it is the mechanism, or possibly the mechanism of kinyan, that you can't do, because that's a safek, and we won't grant him the gift, because we don't know whether he meant to do it through the kinyan of the shtar, which didn't happen before the death, whether he meant to do it simply be miyapek kocho, and since we don't know, motzimi chavero v'alav v'raya, and the yoresh will have to prove, which he obviously will not be able to do because of the ambiguity of the circumstances. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Kuf Lamed Vav, Amud Aleph.